At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's talk. John Brown.
Righting wrongs, 3 decades on the front line battling abusive governments. Kenneth Roth, for 3 decades under the leadership of Kenneth Roth, Human Rights Watch conducted investigations in 100 countries to uncover abuses and pressure defending governments to stop them. It is the subject of a fascinating new book, shining a light on some of the most repulsive regimes. Delighted to say that Kenneth Roth joins us live on the line now. Good morning to you, Mr. Roth.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Whereabouts are you, by the way, this morning?
I'm in London.
Good to have you with us. For those who don't know, explain to me a little bit about A, your career thus far, and B, what Human Rights Watch is, please.
Okay, well, Human Rights Watch is one of the 2 large global human rights organizations, along with Amnesty International. And what the group does is it investigates documents and reports on human rights violations around the world, as you mentioned, in more than 100 countries. And it uses those investigations to put pressure on governments to change, you know, partly by shaming them, since every government pretends to respect human rights, and it's shameful when we show that they fall short, but also by enlisting influential governments to use diplomatic or economic pressure to, in a sense, change the cost-benefit analysis of repression, to make repressive governments realize that their human rights violations just don't pay enough.
That's an interesting way of doing it. So rather than sort of, I mean, obviously you're taking the moral high ground and shining a light on these, but also saying, you know, if you continue to do this, then you're going to be a pariah. And if you hit them in their wallets or in their economies, that's going to hurt them.
No, exactly. And in fact, you know, one reason I wrote this book is that when you tell people that you defend human rights, you know, they tend to say, oh, isn't that nice? You know, but there's nothing you can really do about it. And my point in the book is to show that this is a process of hardball, that we twist governments' arms. We are very successful in pressuring governments to change. And the book is just filled with one example after another of how we succeeded, you know, how we really move governments. And it outlines kind of, it pulls the curtain back on the strategies that we use so people understand it.
What attracted you to this? Because you were you at Princeton before when you had a career as a lawyer? I mean, what was the sort of the chispa, the moment that you decided, I wanted, rather than going off and doing, working for a high-flying law firm, you wanted to get involved in the murky and sometimes, you know, abhorrent world of human rights and shining that light?
You know, my motivation really began with my father. He fled the Nazis as a young boy. And in July 1938, at the age of 12, he left Frankfurt for New York. And so I grew up with Hitler stories. You know, I grew up very aware of the evil that governments could do, and decided I wanted to devote my career to trying to prevent similar evils from emerging.
So how then does it work? How do you get your information? Do you send people on the ground? Because obviously, if this is a repressive regime, they don't say, hey, come in, have a look around our prisons. Come and look, you know, this is where those people went disappearing. So presumably, you send teams in, or you have very brave men and women on the ground who somehow get the information out to you.
Yeah, Human Rights Watch has a team of investigators, and they are based around the world, either in repressive countries or nearby. As much as possible, they travel to the scene of the crime. If that's not possible, they speak to people who were there. They work very much with local activists in these countries. And in some places where the country just shuts down access, these days it's still possible to get information. you know, we have arrangements with a satellite imagery company and can, you know, collect anything that's visible from the sky. Open source analysis is very successful these days because when something significant happens, people take their smartphone, take a picture or video, post it on social media, and we can scrape that for information. You still have to corroborate it. You've got to make sure it's accurate. But there is always a way to find out what's happening. And so, you know, governments try to hide, but they fail to hide their serious human rights violations. When we report on them, they inevitably attack us. They say, oh, you know, you misunderstood, you're biased, whatever. But Human Rights Watch is extraordinarily careful, and it doesn't publish until it's right. And so when the governments attack us, we welcome that because we will win those battles. And ultimately, governments recognize that they're not going to get rid of the bad press until they end the bad conduct. And that's when we begin to make progress.
Looking at some of the campaigns that you've been through, some of the most sort of horrendous ones over the past 30 years, Saddam Hussein going into Kuwait, for example, this is an era before smartphones, before the internet, basically. I mean, that must, and at the up until that point, Saddam Hussein had kind of been seen as our enemy's our friend, if you like, of what was happening with Iran in that region. And suddenly, All those horror stories started coming out because he invaded Kuwait and suddenly he was persona non grata. How difficult was it to compile that information and get stuff coming out from there, Ken?
Well, I mean, in terms of Saddam's atrocities, you know, I tell one story about how we were able to actually document a genocide that he committed against the Kurds, the so-called Anfal campaign, where he used chemical weapons, rounded up young men, and sent them off to the desert and executed them. And there's a whole effort of how we try to bring him to justice there. I mean, he ultimately was, you know, fairly summarily executed by the Iraqi people, but there was a much more systematic effort to bring him before some kind of international tribunal. But I tell a story also of being in Kuwait just after it was liberated by the U.S.-led forces. And there I ended up focusing on atrocities committed by Kuwaitis against mainly Palestinians who were deemed to have sympathized with Saddam. And I cite that story because one important principle that Human Rights Watch follows is that in any conflict situation, we report on all sides. We don't take sides. And we try to hold everybody to the same principles of international human rights or humanitarian law.
Because that could be one of the problems when if you like, the system breaks down, suddenly you get groups. And we're kind of seeing the same thing happening in Syria at the moment with the reports coming out over the weekend was, you know, over 700 killed. Is the fact that the groups who have a tradition or a vested interest or a dislike, but I'm using that in inverted commas, of other groups, seeing them as new arrivals or quote unquote the other, will use the opportunity to take out a traditional, a tribal sort of terrible revenge on them.
Yeah, no, that's always a problem, which is why the Geneva Conventions apply not just to the governments that have ratified them, but also to rebel groups operating in those territories. And Human Rights Watch is very careful to report on all sides. You know, for example, in Gaza, we look obviously at Israeli abuses, but also at Hamas's, at Islamic Jihad. We've looked at Hezbollah's attacks into northern Israel. We've looked at the Palestinian Authority. That's just standard procedure in any conflict around the world. Now, in Syria, I opened the book with a story from Syria because there, while Assad was still in power, one of our big priorities was to stop Syrian and Russian forces from bombing hospitals, schools, markets, apartment buildings in the last territory held by the armed opposition in Idlib in northwestern Syria. And we mounted a campaign, not just by documenting it, because, you know, that wasn't going to be enough to Assad didn't have much reputation left to tarnish. But we also put pressure on Putin. This was before his invasion of Ukraine. He still cared about his reputation. And we enlisted in the end German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Turkish President Erdogan to pressure Putin to stop. And indeed, we got the bombing to stop in March 2020, completely for 3 years. It picked up a little bit, but that territory in Idlib is where HTS, the rebel group, came from that now has toppled Assad. So in essence, we stopped the bombing of millions of civilians sitting in Idlib just through documentation and pressure, ultimately on Putin.
So I suppose one of the things is it's not that direct influence saying, look, you're doing something abhorrent or wrong, or do you realize that your actions, you're arming these people because it might be by proxy rather than going straight in. And then you will get allies or people that the for example, Putin maybe depend on or want the support of, or, you know, have, you know, trade relations with to also lean on them. So it's like, it's peripheral, if you like. And it, so that is a sort of collaborative effort to rein them in.
No, absolutely. In fact, I mean, one lesson that I try to stress in the book is that every abusive leader wants something from the international community. It could be arms sales, it could be military aid, it could be preferential trade benefits. You know, sometimes it's just being invited to a fancy summit and getting his photograph taken with legitimate leaders, you know, to show the folks back home. Our job at Human Rights Watch is to prevent the abusive leader from getting these things until they change their human rights practices. And so in addition to the investigators around the world, Human Rights Watch has advocates in key capitals whose job it is to persuade governments that claim to promote human rights in their foreign policy actually to do that. And that's also a matter of lobbying, of using the media and the like. But it's an important 1-2 punch, because you can tarnish an abusive government's reputation, but you can also ensure they're not going to get what they want until they change their human rights practices.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because all you can say, oh, well, they're just in it for themselves. But yes, you know, every authoritarian leader, every despotic regime wants to be seen to the outside world as being part and strong. And if they abuse human rights, or they have this record, then they're not going to get the recognition, they're not going to get that seat at the table, or they're not going to get that sporting event, or that cultural event, for example, and they won't be able to send their teams or their artists or whatever around the world. And there's nothing worse for North Korea, perhaps accepted, there's nothing worse for somebody like this than being put outside the room and looking in, rather than being on the international stage and seeing how quote-unquote great we are.
That's absolutely the case. And it matters, you know, not just because the leader, you know, has weak self-esteem and wants to be applauded by other leaders around the world, but it's mainly about the folks back home. You know, a leader wants to be able to show his or her domestic audience that they're, you know, seen as a legitimate leader. And it's a way of telling the, you know, people within the country, look, at, you know, you should accept my leadership. I'm not letting you have an election. I'm not giving you a free press or free political parties or civil society, but just accept me as a leader because everybody else does. You know, that's Xi Jinping. That's China, you know, where there's no possibility to elect the Chinese government, but he puts enormous value on being accepted as a legitimate leader by everybody else. And I tell a story in the book about how, you know, when we tried to put China's persecution of the Uyghurs on the agenda of the UN Human Rights Council, Xi Jinping was personally calling up heads of state, asking them to vote with China. That showed how much he cared about his international reputation.
But when it comes to the Uyghurs, a case like that, people might say, well, you know, how can you possibly change anything with China? Because I suppose it's a thing that we mistakenly use broad brushstrokes when it comes to international relationships. So we think of China as inscrutable, and nothing will ever change, and it's so big, and the Uyghurs are somewhere very, very far away. And I suppose that as we said before, if you highlight, because very few people would have even known of the Uyghurs, because they just think China is one amorphous mass, as it were.
Yes. Well, let me just for a moment say, you know, who the Uyghurs are. They are, you know, a Turkic Muslim minority in northwestern China, in what's known as the Xinjiang region. They're a population of about 11 million people, but it's a very sparsely populated area. The Chinese government took about 1 million of those 11 million and threw them in detention with no charge, no trial, nothing, basically to force them to stop being Muslims, to give up their language, and to give up their culture, and just to become, you know, basically Han Chinese, Communist Party, Mandarin-speaking people. And you know, this is blatant persecution. It was one of the worst atrocities in the world. And so Human Rights Watch made a big effort to document what was happening, but also to put pressure on China. And as I said, you know, our main strategy was via the UN, because Xi Jinping really cares about not being denounced by the UN. The so-called High Commissioner for Human Rights, the prior one, Michelle Bachelet, put out a very strong report citing possible crimes against humanity. And we then tried to put this matter on the agenda of the UN Human Rights Council. We failed by 2 votes to get it on the agenda, but we did put enough pressure on Beijing that it began to change its treatment of the Uyghurs. You know, it let some out of detention. It's putting a lot of them into forced labor. So we've had to change our strategy now, and actually got the U.S. government to presumptively bar every import from Xinjiang because it's so likely to have been used and produced by forced labor. We're trying a similar effort with respect to European Union, although Europe is still importing a lot from Xinjiang. It sort of has an ostensible policy against that, but not the same presumption against imports that the United States has. But these are the kinds of things that China feels. You know, they need exports to sustain their sluggish economy. So we try to figure out, okay, you know, what are our leverage points? What are the points of pressure? And we try to put our thumb on them.
Talking of points of pressure, I mean, you're dealing with some pretty nasty people here. I mean, your operatives, who are compiling this, and yourselves. Do you ever get sort of phone calls in the middle of the night, or cars following, all that sort of thing? Because these are people, you know, a lot of times these are despotic regimes, and they don't like having people probing into their countries, and will take actions to make sure that you don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the case. And, you know, we pay great attention to the security of our staff. But I tell one story in the book about Tanya Lakshina, who was our Moscow director, a Russian woman. And she did great investigations in Chechnya, really around the country. But at one point, she was going to go to Dagestan, which is a republic in the North Caucasus. And the Russian government clearly didn't want her to go there. And they started texting her threats, you know, pretending to be a local imam. They had all this personal information about her. She was pregnant at the time. And basically, because of these death threats, we had to pull her out of the country for a brief bit, although we didn't do that without holding a press conference and denouncing all of this. And the last threats we got were the morning of the press conference, and we just went forward with the press conference anyhow. So, yes, these things happen. We are careful, though. We try, we don't need to be where the shooting takes place. We can talk to somebody who was there, and that gives us a degree of safety. But of course, you know, abusive governments sometimes try to silence the messenger as a way of covering up their atrocities. And so we have to, you know, do what we can to protect our staff.
We were talking a little bit earlier about tribes and how Saddam had the tribes, you know, had this war against this genocide against the Kurdish people. Rwanda. And, you know, I mean, I remember, obviously, those of us of a certain generation will remember Rwanda, and perhaps a younger generation won't. But that was tribal massacre at its most horrendous. How do you even compute, if you like, what's going on? And when the reports start coming in, or you go out there and you see the absolute brutality of what was happening there?
Well, Human Rights Watch actually put out a report about this persecution before the genocide started, as a warning. It went forward anyway. Once the genocide happened, we spent a lot of time documenting it. We played a central role in getting basically all the top persecutors prosecuted by an international tribunal. So they're all in prison at this stage. So, you know, that was kind of retrospectively an important success. But one thing I spent a lot of time talking about in the book is that Paul Kagame, at the time, the head of the rebel group that stopped the genocide, currently president, longtime president and dictator of Rwanda, his troops also executed 30,000 people at the time, and he's never been held to account for that. Today, he's sponsoring a rebel group known as the M23, which has invaded eastern Congo, has taken the two largest cities there of Goma and Bukavu, is committing atrocities left and right. And Kagame gets away with this because he portrays himself as a, you know, responsible leader, even though there's no dissent allowed in Rwanda. And, he is just exploiting eastern Congo's minerals, which Europe is buying, without regard to the killing that is taking place. Something similar happened 10 years ago, and Human Rights Watch was able to stop it by documenting Rwanda's support for the M23, getting the US and the UK to call Kagame and tell him to cut it off, or else they were going to cut their aid. And it stopped. The M23 dissolved within days. But it came back a few years ago, and Western governments are not putting the same kind of pressure on Kagame, so the people of Eastern Congo are suffering. And this is just an illustration that, you know, when somebody enjoys impunity for terrible atrocities, they're likely to commit more. And Kagame thinks, you know, because he sponsors Arsenal, you know, because he sends peacekeepers to Mozambique, that he somehow is untouchable despite the atrocities he commits in Eastern Congo.
When you started working with Human Rights Watch 30 years ago, no such thing as the internet, no such thing as social media. And this has obviously changed the landscape completely. And you only need to go on certain platforms to see bots or whatever decrying and saying, oh, well, what do these people know? You're part of the legacy. You're part of the mainstream. You've got an agenda. Everybody's got a bleeding agenda. But you know what I'm saying? And you can, people don't, people read the hashtag and not the whole story, Ken. I mean, how difficult do you now find it to put the stuff out there without saying, well, you've got an agenda, you're just working for whoever it is, and how has that changed the work that you do?
Well, it's a double-edged sword. Let me start with the good news, which is to say that the evolution of communications technology has completely transformed human rights work. Because when I started, you either traveled to a country or you made very expensive international phone calls, which couldn't be done very often. And so information flowed much more slowly. And it was only bigger atrocities that could be addressed. But with the emergence of the internet, social media, smartphones, information goes instantaneously. And so the human rights movement can, you know, aspire and often succeed in learning about an abuse today and ending it tomorrow. So the speed of the effort is really picked up, and that helps to save lives. The downside, of course, as you note, is that it's not just the good guys who have access to social media. You know, it's also all the people spreading disinformation and hatred. And so, you know, the internet is a complicated place. And if you, you know, open your whatever your social media platform is, you get a lot of garbage there too. And we depend on people to try to, you know, work through it. Now, those who want the truth, and the truth is still very powerful. That's why governments make such an effort to suppress it. If you want the truth, you go to respected sources. You go to Human Rights Watch. You go to kind of the leading media outlets. But, you know, some people are just lazy and they believe whatever garbage shows up. So, you know, that is a challenge, but I still believe in the power of truth. And I believe that enough people want access to the truth that this basic process of shaming abusive governments remains very powerful.
What is the aim of Righting Wrongs? Is it to showcase the work you do and obviously to explain how you do it and also some of the successes that you've had?
Yeah, I mean, I want people to understand the power of the human rights movement. Because if they recognize that it's not just a nice thing to do, but actually a way to change governmental conduct, that's when they join in. And one message I try to leave readers with is that people say, oh, you know, what can I do? I'm just an individual. But the process of shaming requires a strong public sense of right and wrong. Because if you spotlight something and people applaud, you don't change the government's conduct. But if they disapprove, that's when we begin to make progress. And so because people tend to believe their friends, their family members, their acquaintances at work, more than some distant media outlet, what you say, you know, around the coffee machine or what you post on social media is influential in reinforcing the public sense of right and wrong, which is what we need ultimately to make progress in changing governmental conduct.
When you look back at the 30 years documented in this book, what are you perhaps, or you, with your team, are you perhaps most, you think that is why we did what we did and that is why we made the difference?
Well, I mean, the stories I tell and the ones that really get me excited are about particular countries where we did change things. But, you know, people often cite some of the big global campaigns that we led. You know, we shared a Nobel Peace Prize for securing a treaty to ban anti-personnel landmines, which have now saved, you know, thousands upon thousands of people from being killed or maimed. We got a similar treaty banning indiscriminate cluster munitions. We helped to establish the International Criminal Court, which today is, you know, charged Putin for kidnapping Ukrainian children and Netanyahu for starving Palestinian civilians in Gaza. So these big global efforts that succeeded, you know, despite opposition from the United States, Russia, and China, those are big steps that I'm very proud of.
The book is called Righting Wrongs, 3 decades on the Front Lines Battling Abusive Governments. It's by Kenneth Roth, who we're speaking to today. Ken, if people want to find you online and say nice things, where is the best place to find you or indeed the organization?
Well, Human Rights Watch is at hrw.org. And my personal website is kenroth.org.
And you'll be able to, listeners, you'll be able to order the book via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Righting Wrongs. It's by Kenneth Roth. Kenneth, it's been an absolute pleasure, nay, an honor to speak to you this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.